This is FM 90.1 KZFR Chico, listener-supported community radio for the Sacramento Valley, the foothills, and beyond. Up next, Ecotopia. Tonight, we'll be continuing our conversations on radical change with a discussion of how COVID-19 creates some opportunities for progress and radical change.
Blackbird singing in the dead of night. Take these broken wings and learn to fly. All your life, you were only waiting for this moment to arrive. Blackbird singing in the dead of night. Take these sunken eyes.
This is Ecotopia on KZFR, exploring ecosystems, environmental, social, technological. Tonight's program is a replay of one we did a few weeks ago with Paul Ehrlich. He's the author of the 1968 classic Population Bomb and more recently the founder of the Millennium Alliance for Humanity and the Biosphere. Also on the conversation is Dan Blumstein. He's a professor in the Department of Ecology and Evolutionary Biology at UCLA. They spoke with us about prioritizing environmental and other changes in the wake of COVID-19, and their topic is why let a good crisis go to waste. Ecotopia is made possible by the generous contributions of our listeners and by the Corona-conscious Chico Certified Farmers Markets, offering year-round markets on Wednesday mornings and the North Valley Plaza at the North Valley Plaza, Saturday mornings at 3rd and Wall. Chico Certified Farmers Markets, bringing together food lovers and farmers since 1980. We want to remind you that the opinions expressed on Ecotopia do not necessarily express the views of KZFR, its staff, board of directors, volunteers, underwriters, or programmers. We'll take just a minuscule two-second break and then listen to our previously recorded interview with Paul Ehrlich and Dan Blumstein.
Yeah.
This is Ecotopia on KZFR, and the title of this program is Never Let a Good Crisis Go to Waste. That's a quote from Winston Churchill toward the end of World War II. He was with Stalin and FDR at the time, but it was part of a movement toward forming the United Nations in the wake of World War II. That's also the title of an article written by our two guests in a recent edition of the blog of the Millennium Alliance for Humanity and the Biosphere.
Daniel T. Blumstein is a professor of ecology and evolutionary biology and the Institute of the Environment and Sustainability at the University of California, Los Angeles. He has authored or co-authored over 300 articles in peer-reviewed scientific journals and is co-author of a book entitled The Failure of Environmental Education and How We Can Fix It.
We're probably not going to have a chance to talk about that book today, Dan, but we'd like to hear about it at some point. We're former educators and teacher educators, so we're interested in that as well.
Well, and I can rant about that as much as you'd like.
Right. Our other guest has been with us on Ecotopia several times in recent years. Paul Ehrlich is president of the Center for Conservation Biology at Stanford and the leading force behind the Millennium Alliance for Humanity and the Biosphere. The acronym is MAHB, and it's pronounced the MOB. He's been an environmental leader for well over a half century. Many of us remember his and his wife's pioneering book, The Population Bomb, first published in 1968, which is about when I read it, and that launched serious discussion of the pending global population disaster. So welcome, Paul Ehrlich.
Nice to be back.
And welcome, Dan.
Thank you.
I didn't say that.
The article we're talking about, you co-wrote with Corey Bradshaw from Flinders University in Adelaide. What is the significance of the title quote, "Never let a good crisis go to waste"?
Yeah, I mean, good leaders are always looking for ways to change things, and things often change quickly when there's a real pressing need to change things quickly. Our economy is collapsing around us. Many people are suffering. There's going to have to be a rebuilding, and part of this crisis can be an opportunity to fix some other structural failings in our global systems that are going to lead to other forms of coronavirus-like disasters. Mm-hmm. And these are just waiting around us, and we wrote this essay to highlight two of them.
Yeah, you just think that because Trump is killing tens of thousands of people now, that's a really bad crisis. But of course, if you look at the potential of global climate disruption, the scale of death there could easily be in the billions, because it will unfortunately badly affect the agricultural system. We're on a planet where already roughly 2 billion people do not have adequate diets. Almost a billion are underfed, and more than a billion are short of vital nutrients, micronutrients particularly. So we should learn the lesson from this crisis that the community as a whole and the politicians ought to listen very carefully to the warnings of scientists, because they warned about this pandemic for more than half a century, loudly and continuously, and they've warned about climate disruption for almost as long, and yet nothing is being done about it.
I think the particularly annoying thing about this is, you know, experts knew that coronaviruses are an issue. Our government and other governments funded research into these things. There's a script towards detecting and dealing with spillovers, disease spillovers from wild populations. And this just happened on our watch while we knew exactly what was going to happen.
Mm-hmm. And we know what needs to be done today, and it's not being done.
Which is even more extraordinary.
Save many thousands of lives now by doing things that we know perfectly well, particularly having a federal government that coordinated a response to the coronavirus, like many other countries have. But we have a gang of thugs running the country, and you can't trust thugs to really do the right thing.
So what are some things that you think should be done? We know what needs to be done. What are those things?
We have to have a coordinated response from the top. We have to discuss policy outcomes, but have policy outcomes be informed by the best science. The epidemiological models are well understood. Parameterizing them is difficult. We need to up testing to better parameterize models. We need to get people together. We need to create a social movement to do the right thing. Some groups of people are doing that, and that's really nice. But then you sort of see groups of people going armed into, you know, government state houses protesting the right to be a free American. And that's really depressing.
Yeah,
we're all in this one together.
Yeah, the previous administration had something like 24 people in their pandemic task force in China keeping their eyes open for this sort of thing. And that was reduced by the Trump administration to 4 people. They disbanded the special unit that was in the White House in order to look at and warn the country about the approach of pandemics. And everybody knew in January that this was going to be horrendous, and the administration downplayed it for more than 2 months and is now urging people to do what is basically insane. That is, get out, crowd around. The viruses are very happy, let me tell you, with this, with the current performance of the thugs in the White House. And country is exposing itself to what could be a horrendous whiplash back from the virus.
Mm-hmm. Paul, a major goal of MOB has to get people thinking more about science, believing in it, and kind of bridge the gap between citizens and scientists. I wonder if you could talk about this. A lot of people are distrusting science at the moment. I've heard it from people face to face. It's fake news. It's not real. They're just making it up to sell sell vaccines.
It's really scary and weird. Of course, they all use their cell phones created by scientists. They all fly on airplanes, and the airplanes actually most of the time get up there and bring them to where they want to go and get them down safely and so on. But when the scientists tell them things that they're doing that are extremely dangerous, it's difficult for them to see it the same way. And it's largely, in my view, a response from a broken educational system. Mm-hmm. I'm at a little university that may be the best in the world, although Dan sometimes disagrees, where you can get all the way through the university without even knowing what exponential growth is. If you can see, the entire Congress of the United States seems to have trouble with a very, very simple mathematical construct, arithmetic, basically. But we don't teach it to everybody at Stanford, nor do we teach them how many people there are in the world. And again, this is, you can learn it at Stanford from different professors, but the university as a whole does not see to it that people understand why you can't recycle gasoline, why the loss of biodiversity could be lethal to society, what are ecosystem services, what are externalities. There's all sorts of things, and our educational system is not designed to teach them. At Stanford, the departmental structure was created by an old colleague of mine that you may have met sometime. His name was Aristotle. And you find yourself a department at Stanford within which any important human problem could be solved. That is, without going to other departments. People brag about interdisciplinary study, but of course the basic problem is the disciplines are ancient and make no sense anymore. And yet the University of Stanford is doing nothing but worrying about how to keep the students and the money flow going. The president of Stanford has not said one word that I can detect about the current situation, about the threats that are coming at us beyond it that we should be paying a lot of attention to, and so on. Just think about it. I don't think you've heard any university president in the United States yet become a public scholar discussing the current situation of the world and the human predicament.
So now, many
can differ with me.
Many schools do have sustainability course requirements, and
yes,
what Paul's, you know, referring to is that Stanford doesn't. We don't at UCLA have one either.
It's also that every university should make sure that every student is involved in these things. There are many great faculty members working very hard to solve the predicament.
Well, and in our book, The Failure of Environmental Education and How We Can Fix It, we call for teaching people citizenship. And everything that Paul rattled off is about citizenship. Citizenship is knowing how society works, both politically and ecologically and environmentally. Citizenship is about teaching people to preserve what is life sustaining and necessary. Citizenship is environmental education, basically, and in its all multidisciplinary dimensions. Yeah. And well-trained citizens are going to seek out information to base decisions on, which doesn't say that the politics isn't going to happen, and it doesn't say that people don't have strong opinions one way or the other, but it's stupid to base decisions on hearsay rather than data.
I want to pounce on both of your comments, because we've been advocates of genuine interdisciplinary education for a long time. If I ran the school, elementary and secondary schools would be strictly thematic, interdisciplinary, and probably the first couple years of college education as well. Take problems and explore them.
Yep.
One of the models, I was a chemistry major a long time ago, and it amuses me to go into college classrooms and see the periodic table still posted on the lecture hall walls.
It gets bigger every year.
We're going to march through the families. A book that changed my thing, I read Isaac Asimov's History of Chemistry long time after I had failed as a chemist, and discovered the history that, for example, the alchemists were not lunatics who were just trying to turn lead into gold. They were thinking about the nature of the change of matter. And that kind of broad look at our science would make a huge difference for people. As it is now, we kind of march through the periodic table or whatever biological concepts are out there, and kids don't make the connections.
Yeah, the good professors and the good classes are doing that, and the good places.
Yes.
And, you know, it's a challenge teaching that through Zoom, where you really do need to see people in their eyes and, you know, get them engaged personally.
Right.
And, you know, we'll get back to that at some point, but not anytime soon.
We're kind of thinking that Zoom online classes are primarily for conveying information. They don't work well for inquiry, interaction.
It's harder.
It is harder. Good.
Yeah, the psychologists have looked at this. One of the things that I remember from way back when is they did a study of lecturing and how effective lecturing was passing on information and getting students to understand. And they found out that the students learned a lot more if each student had a button that they could press. If the professor said, press the button twice, if that's the answer, or once, if that's the answer, students learned a lot more, even though the buttons didn't have any connection to.
Right. Okay. Sort of like the street crossing things.
Yeah. Well, I mean, lecturing is a miserable way to teach anybody anything, basically. Yeah. But we still do it because the universities are very, very, very conservative. We've been trying hard, and a number of us, to bring Stanford into the 20th century, but we failed. It's still a 19th century university with 19th century disciplines, even though it has many of the best environmental scientists in the world working very hard. It's amazing because of the way the finances of universities work that, for example, Stanford, talking about sustainability, has yet to divest from fossil fuels, even though that symbolic act, if all the universities in the country did it simultaneously, particularly, could have some impact on policy.
UCLA divested this year, which I thought was a very good decision.
Chico State divested two years ago.
Yeah. Harvard and Stanford are still holdouts. And Harvard is, of course, one of the worst universities in the country. But even that's Stanford makes a nice bookend to Harvard. Stanford's high quality, Harvard's you know, dull, Eastern, not too bright group.
Can we talk a little bit about your article?
I do that.
Okay.
I haven't read it.
It's really interesting.
Let me just briefly identify for our listeners. This is Ecotopia. We're talking with Dan Blumstein of UCLA, Paul Ehrlich of Stanford, about their recent article, Never Let a Good Crisis Go to Waste.
And one of the two areas of action you bring up in your article is the widespread use of animal antibiotics. Can you describe that whole problem,
yeah,
that whole issue?
Absolutely. I mean, we use antibiotics way too much. So you don't have to believe in science, but, you know, you don't have to believe in evolution, but evolution is going to kill you. And evolution is going to kill you because of widespread antibiotic resistance. So when we put antibiotics into the environment, we're selecting for bacteria that don't respond to antibiotics. The more you try to kill something, the stronger it gets. So we evolve resistance. And the way these bacteria work and these resistance genes work is they can jump from organism to organism, which is really interesting. We do this when we take antibiotics, and we do this when we give antibiotics to livestock and animals. And the food industry is all about giving lots of antibiotics to livestock because it makes them grow faster. So a cheap economic input, antibiotics, allows people to profit more at the widespread risk of evolving resistance that we will then not be able to be treated for later on.
Yeah, about 3/4 of antibiotics around the world are fed to animals. We overuse them on ourselves, as Dan has said, but dumping huge amounts of them into the environment because of those jumping genes and so on means that many people fear that we are moving out of the antibiotic era. And I'm old enough to remember, for example, when I was a kid in the 30s, I had scarlet fever, which couldn't be dealt with by antibiotics at that time. I was quarantined and I almost died. My closest 3 of my childhood friends died of diseases that would not kill them today because we have still antibiotics, but we are running a huge risk of getting rid of them. And as Dan said, you know, my first graduate student job in 1953 was studying the evolution of resistance to DDT in fruit flies. And at that time, it was crystal clear to me and all my lab mates and my professor that we were running huge risks if we overused antibiotics. It's like climate change and the pandemics. It's no surprise. The scientific community has known about this risk and warned about it for more than half a century, and yet we still vastly overuse antibiotics and don't use some of the tools we could have to make the resistance more difficult to evolve.
How do we get the will and the knowledge to make this change?
There's the question.
Yeah.
When some group of people at Stanford decided to start a school of sustainability, they said that there would be no social sciences, which shows you how insane the education system is, because in my view, virtually all the action today is in areas thought of as the social sciences. The scientific community knows well enough what steps we should be taking, what direction we should be going. It's not that we can't use some more research and do a little better, but we know what we have to do. The big mystery is, why the hell aren't we doing it? But Dan has the answer, I'm sure.
I would just say that really it's the compelling questions are not the scientific questions, as Paul said. We kind of know enough. It's the behavioral science questions. It's why we behave as we behave. And it's how you encourage people to maybe do the right thing. What's so depressing about the coronavirus pandemic right now is that we're asking people to do something with an immediate direct benefit for themselves, their neighbors, their relatives. And it's a very obvious thing. And the economy. But I mean, just direct things. If you don't go out, if you wear masks, if you reduce transmission, if we get R naught below 1, if we can, you know, squash this thing, it's good for you personally. All of these other things, you're asking for actions that have a delayed outcome. And that's much harder. The causality isn't as clear, even though the causality is crystal clear with antibiotics, which is why this is such a simple one. And it befuddles me why we can't encourage our politicians to do the right thing, which is put serious constraints on the overuse of antibiotics in agriculture.
One of the things that we interviewed Margaret Solomon of Climate Mobilization, and she said, and I was asking about why can't we get people to move more quickly on climate change, and she partially put it at the feet of scientists, that they're supposed to be impartial. They're supposed to just give you the information. They're not supposed to take a side because that would mean that they're biased in some way. And I wonder if this isn't true for the antibiotics issue. I agree with you about the importance of the social sciences.
I think it's corruption. I think it's corruption in the election system. The fact that so much money is in campaigns, the fact to get elected, you need to spend millions of dollars, you know, for Senate seats and House seats. And where does this money come from? It comes from industries with agendas. It comes from, you know, the coal lobby. It comes from the fossil fuel and gas lobby. And it comes from big agriculture. So as soon as you, and Al Gore wrote about this in a book after he, you know, stepped down from being vice president, you know, all good politicians write about this after they step down from needing that money. You've got to break that chain. You have to have campaign finance reform. And that's what breaks everything.
But should scientists be more outspoken?
Scientists, in my view, I think Dan's should be more outspoken. I think one of the great pieces of nonsense is to say that scientists should not give opinions on really important world issues. So you take the people who have studied it most intensively for the longest period of time, and learned everything they can. People like Dan and I spend more time studying than 99% of graduate students in the world, because we understand you've got to know a huge amount. So you take the people who have concentrated and learned everything they possibly can about a difficult problem, and then you tell them to shut up, not give their opinion. It's really important, and Steve Schneider and Dan and I have all talked about this, to make it clear when you're giving the scientific consensus. If you disagree with that consensus, make it clear why you disagree and what the data are, and then you give your opinion. I, for example, I broke the rule at a meeting of the National Academy of Sciences that less than like about a week ago, when I told my group that the only job I saw for a scientist who was not working directly on something like the SARS-2 virus right now, the only thing that they should be doing for the rest of the year as scientists is doing everything they can to see to it that Trump and his Republican thugs are not reelected. That is the job of a scientist who understands what's going on in the world. When you see, you know, funnily enough, they don't really complain about the doctors that say smoking will kill you. But when an ecologist says, if you let the climate disruption go on, that will kill billions of people, that somehow is bad. It's a very interesting phenomenon.
I think that scientists have a role to maintain credibility, but I think you can maintain credibility while, as Paul said, saying and sharing publicly what stems from your expertise. And if you differ from the consensus viewpoint out there, explain why. I think many scientists are trying to be heard. I think there is a credibility problem. And you see in the current coronavirus exchanges that some people are writing outside their specialties, and that's either good or bad. Some people are writing outside their specialties, not necessarily in a good way. And some people are writing outside their specialties to sort of expand the conversation, which I think is good. Society in general, democratic society, if it's functioning, people will make collective decisions mm-hmm. based on information and based on ideas. These ideas have to be compelling. These ideas have to involve storytelling. And scientists who've studied things are probably in a pretty good position, with help, to tell good stories and move people and make them recognize, make us all recognize what's important and why. There are decisions you can make about discount rates. So, I mean, all of these social sciences are also important in thinking about what your discount rates are. The philosophy of global climate disruption is profoundly important. How ethical, how moral is it to doom future generations to incredible costs and suffering versus pain and suffering now? And that's a discussion for we don't really have intergenerational ethics, as Steve Gardner wrote in a phenomenal book, thinking about the perfect moral storm, which is the real problems with climate change.
So you can actually see the ethical issues very clearly in the issue of antibiotics. Your kid has an ear infection, and you go to the doctor, and the doctor says, well, it's probably this bacterium. Shall we give him antibiotics? And on one hand, if you give him antibiotics, it could conceivably could save his life. Not likely. It's usually the ear infections resolve themselves without antibiotics, but it could. On the other hand, if you give him antibiotics, you may be contributing to your great-grandchildren living in a world in which there's no antibiotics. And so these are difficult ethical issues. But unfortunately, at either scale, what Dan was talking about, or at that lower level, there's almost no ethical discussion in our society today. I mean, what are the ethics of a president of the United States suggesting that people who have SARS-2 virus should try drinking Lysol or Drano to cure themselves? Mm-hmm. Now, actually, I have to put a commercial in here. Ann and I have a company. We're selling Drano Cola, which is a carbonated flavored Drano for your children if they're willing to take Drano. And we guarantee that if your child drinks a full can of Drano, the child will never spike a fever again.
<That's good. laughs> Okay, so we've talked both your first. I'm pulling us back to the, because I don't know, OCD or something, pulling us back to the article. But I wanted to say one more thing before we do this. I mean, why are conspiracy theories so prevalent, and why are people much more willing to believe the facts of the conspiracy theories than they are scientists? And we've sort of talked about this, but
I want to make sure this is not polarized. This is not a left or a right thing. It's not just conservative people that have conspiracy theories. Think about the anti-vaxxers. And what's completely terrifying is there is already a movement to not do whatever vaccine comes out of this. We lose over 1 million people globally every year because from seasonal flu. 1 million people every year. And we have vaccines every year that work to some degree, probably better than nothing. But people don't get vaccinated. They choose not to get vaccinated, or they can't get vaccinated because they don't have access.
And there's no risk of smallpox at all. And why is that?
Right.
Curiously enough, vaccination works.
So it's not a left or a right thing.
Yeah.
Everyone's looking for conspiracies. We're humans. We find patterns. I mean, you know, superstition is fascinating. We're always looking for causal links. And these days, in this hyper-partisan world, which I think is going to kill us and is killing us, I mean, we can see the consequences of being hyper-polarized and hyper-partisan. People are going to look for whatever story that makes sense to them because they don't want to, quote, believe what, quote, the truth might be. The truth is scary. The world is scary out there. And all successful organisms have learned to live with their fear. I have a book coming out in September called The Nature of Fear. And, you know, if we look back through 4.5 billion years of life on Earth, we are descendants from organisms that have successfully managed risk and successfully managed fear. And it is scary out there. And fear and responding to it makes us humans. We cannot eliminate risk. We're never going to eliminate mortality and mortality risk, but we can manage it. We can reduce it. And we reduce it. And if we look at all of the organisms on Earth that reduce it and survive and leave descendants, they basically get information from wherever they can. So we should be getting information. We should be using information. We should be making decisions based on information.
But I agree with all of that. And I recommend his book highly because I know his research in this area. And I agree with it, too. But there is some information that everybody has that can help you fight the conspiracy theories. And that is, conspiracies are huge numbers of people keeping a great secret. Well, you've all had the test of telling one close friend a secret and finding out that it has spread across the country in a matter of days. In other words, we're the species that has the least ability of any species on the planet, I guarantee it, to keep secrets. I mean, I've worked with chimpanzees. They've never let me in on their secrets. But many of my Homo sapiens friends have always told me their secrets. So the idea, for example, that, you know, 10,000 physicians are part of a conspiracy to overuse antibiotics or to sick you into using vaccines because they make money at it. What are the chances of it actually being kept secret? So everybody has, it's weird, everybody has the experience to know that conspiracies are really tough to generate. God knows I try and do, I mean, the whole Drano Cola thing is a conspiracy, basically. Yeah. But now you know about it. I couldn't resist telling you.
I have to chip in with some childhood stories. I was a teller of tall tales as a kid and could do it with a very straight face and got bitten several times when outrageous tall tales came back and people reported them as being true. I heard it from a friend of mine who heard it from a reliable yep. friend of mine. There we went. So I don't do that anymore.
So the two action items, coming back to the article, the two action items, one is to get control of antibiotics. And the second, which we've been talking about since the very beginning of our discussion, is about climate change. So what do you see as the relationship between COVID-19 and climate change and how this can affect discussions of climate?
I think it's illustrating the consequences of not solving problems when you can solve them inexpensively, and the huge social disruption that occurs when you have global problems. I knew this was going to be bad. I couldn't imagine. I did not think through this enough to sort of imagine the sort of apocalyptic horror film nature of what really is going on around the world now. And climate disruption, if we don't get this under control, it's going to lead to magnitudes more suffering and death and destruction and collapse of the economies around the world. And we can do it. And we can do it now, and we can do it less. And the theme that ties both of these ideas together is one that we're going to, you know, spend money to rebuild our society after many, many people have lost their jobs. And why not execute some Green New Deal? Sensu lato. Doesn't have to be AOC's version of a Green New Deal. But, you know, why not use this as an opportunity? Never let a crisis go to waste. Why not use this as an opportunity to think broadly, to think interdisciplinarily, to think about what other existential threats are to our livelihoods and our society and our citizens and our people and our biosphere, and to work to address those now. Because this is a dry run of how expensive it can be, and we don't even know the total expense, by ignoring the evidence that we have had for years in front of us.
We have evolved in the wrong way, unfortunately, for dealing with problems like this, so that it requires the kind of thing that Dan is talking. For most of our evolution, we learn to do things like, for instance, if somebody throws a rock at your head, you do a series of differential equations very rapidly and duck. And we evolved to deal with issues like that. And in part, what we did was learn to keep the environmental background steady so we could see the leopard approaching or the rock coming at our head and so on. We didn't evolve to deal with things like climate change, because Australopithecus, if the climate was changing, its choices were to mutate or migrate. It either could move or it could evolve, but it couldn't deal with it. And now the terrible things are changes in our overall background environment. And I give you an example which most people wouldn't consider environmental, but which I do. The gradual buildup of nuclear weapons, and recently the refusing of the one arm of our triad, that is the submarine-based nuclear weapons, to make them more accurate, has scared the wits out of Russians, yeah. The Russians, and greatly increased the chances of a nuclear war. I'm often asked, Are the disasters that are coming going to wipe out Homo sapiens, make us extinct? Well, climate disruption may have that potential, but a worldwide nuclear war, by accident even, could easily do it. And that's a really scary thing that people just can't pay attention to. I find it hard to remain as scared as I ought to be about a nuclear exchange, particularly when you have people with their hands on nuclear weapons that clearly are mixes of imbeciles and evil. And I got to also admit with Dan, I was surprised by the pandemic. Primarily, I could not have imagined the level of evil and incompetence that came from the U.S. administration, killing tens of thousands of people by neglect for political reasons. They want to end the government. I don't know what they imagine, how you can imagine around the world that 8 billion people can be organized somehow without any form of governance. Maybe, of course, they never talk. In theory, they never give you any answer. They believe that poor people and people with darker skins should die, but they don't come out up front with that. They just keep working to see that it happens.
Yeah. So do you see leadership that will do the kinds of things that both of you are asking?
Not in the U.S. right now, unfortunately, and that's really sad. So, you know, you may have issues with the American hegemony, but she has kept you safe, and she has kept the world safe. And what we have seen is the complete collapse of that hegemony since World War II, really, after World War I, but certainly World War II. And that's improved the lots of many people. And yeah, there's some downsides to what we've done, but there have been many, many upsides. And we have a rudderless world right now, and the UN ain't going to solve it. The WHO is going to be an important part of this, but the WHO can't solve this particular problem alone.
And even the CDC in the United States has been gutted.
Gutted. And you know, what we see from looking left at our evolutionary ancestors, we are descended from organisms that, you know, seek wise cooperations whenever possible. And you just don't do it alone. So when the leaders are saying we're going to do it alone and it's going to be good for us, that's a recipe for disaster. And we see it right now.
Yeah. You wrote another article. This is a favorite topic of mine, about the need for a shadow cabinet. This is an idea that Susan and I have supported since, given our time teaching in London. Tell us about the shadow cabinet, and then let's go from there to how we could see change on the scale that we need to make a difference.
Yeah, Tom Friedman wrote an op-ed in the New York Times a while ago where he sort of said, hey, you know, Biden, the presumptive nominee, should think about who his cabinet's going to be, and look at all of these vice presidential candidates, or look at all these former presidential candidates who could be here, here, here. And it was a nice parlor game. Paul and I were having a drink and talking about this as a parlor game. I think we need a shadow cabinet. You know, we need actually to sort of pull this together and have a group of adults in the room that are saying, here's what we can do, and here's what we would do if we were in power. And this is not meant to sort of be a coup. This is just paralleling sort of constitutional, non-constitutional systems, but the parliamentary systems in other countries like the UK, where there is the government in control, and then there's the shadow government, where everyone has a role in that, and they sort of produce and propose alternative ideas. And, you know, if the Democrats were to put together a shadow government and they came up with some good ideas and those ideas were taken, wouldn't that be great? Isn't it kind of interesting that universal basic income kind of happened in a couple of weeks after the government started doing something? And that was something that you would never expect to come from a Republican administration.
And it was an idea that was around 100
Republican administrations.
Yeah, that idea started 150 years ago, roughly, is clearly something that needs to be discussed. But, it would be wonderful to have maybe Kamala Harris as the attorney general discussing, for example, what the indictment she would put forward for the multiple crimes by Barr and by Trump, both of whom have obstructed justice, lied to Congress, on and on and on, one crime after another. And I think it would also attract the press, because right now I don't see any opposition. In other words, there is no clear opposition party in this country. In countries that have parliaments, there's always an opposition party, and they always have a shadow government. The problem of finding better leadership than we have now would be easy because there are always rescue dogs in pounds. And any mutt from the street would be infinitely preferable to the present president.
We took some solace this week that Joe Biden and Bernie Sanders have come forward with a series of task forces that are going to look at things like immigration, education, health, and so forth. Don't know if you've studied that at this point, but do you have any thoughts? Is that something like a shadow cabinet with potential for the Democrats to actually put forth a coherent
plan? I mean, you win elections not by being in opposition to someone. You win elections because you get hearts and minds and you have an alternative vision that people want to subscribe to. So you don't win by saying, I am not Trump. You win because people believe in what you're pushing forward. So it is not a moment too late for the Democrats to create a vision of how the world would look if they were in charge, or how the U.S. would look if they were in charge. Biden's got to get out of his basement and do something. So
there are a bunch of social psychologists who have been asked to help the Democrats in this area. One of them is a close friend of mine, and he says they're not paying the slightest attention. There's nobody home. They're arguing over trivia. You got to attract the media, and I can't blame the media for not covering the Democrats, because they're not giving them anything to cover. It's another social science area which unfortunately is being neglected. I wish I could give you a nice answer. I don't have any strong opinions about the current political situation.
No, not at all.
We've all gone silent.
Well, I'll say something. One of the things that I find most disturbing to me personally, besides the disappointment over seeing many things that all of us have argued about for decades not happening or happening in the wrong way, but I also find that most of my knowledgeable colleagues are puzzled about what to do. In other words, they're uncertain. There's so many norms have been fractured. Cy Levin and I used to work on the evolution of norms. And one of our great findings, we thought, was that unpopular laws can turn into norms. And the example is smoking. When the first anti-smoking laws in bars and restaurants came in, they were very unpopular. If you lit up in a Palo Alto restaurant tonight, if they were open, you would be thrown out on your butt. They wouldn't call the cops. There's now a norm. You do not light up cigarettes in a restaurant. And yet, Trump has demolished more norms than any of us can remember. And we really are all sort of at sea, because every time you think about it, in my view, the world has changed so much that everything's going to have to change if we're going to have a chance. In other words, one of the arguments I made with my scientific colleagues is they keep taking a blunt knife to a gunfight the academy is not supposed to do X, Y, and Z, while the government is doing A through Z prime all the time. In other words,
But Paul's point about norms being changed quickly is actually, we got ourselves in these problems. We can get ourselves out of these problems. So norms can change quickly. And what has impressed me, throughout my career is just looking at Paul basically bang his head against the wall for his whole career. And, but things can change quickly. If we keep this up, if we keep people aware, if we continue, Trump has shown things can change quickly, maybe in ways that neither of us like. But things can change quickly in the other way. Smoking is a perfect example of that. At some point, maybe everyone in the U.S. will decide it's kind of rude if you don't wear a mask when you go outside during a pandemic. And wouldn't that be interesting? And many people feel that way. Not everyone, but many people. So, you know, we can change our behavior. Behavioral change is going to be what's necessary to solve these problems.
I have to add to that that although my friends are all uncertain, they're all making plans to do something. In other words, there is a movement in the scientific community and in the social and in the civil society of people who want to do something and are getting out and thinking about it. And of course, the youngsters, they're much more a threat than we are. And they're going, they're beginning to take action. So it isn't hopeless, but even if it's hopeless, we've got to keep fighting.
That's right.
Tell us more about what you think individuals can do. This is, we raise this question with our listeners every week. What, here's the listeners, here's us sitting here. What can we do individually? Where can we find allies? Suggestions.
If you're young enough and active enough, do what several of my colleagues are doing, did 2 years ago and are doing now. Move to some place where a lot of people, particularly people of color or Hispanics, one of my friends who's born in Mexico, went into the Central Valley for 2 months to help defeat one of the worst Republican congressmen there. And they've made reservations to go to one of the, I think it's Arizona, it's either Arizona or South Carolina, to register voters at the just before the election and so on. And even writing letters to your congressman, anything you can do, call them up. Don't be polite. Picket their offices, although maintain your 6 feet or more spacing. But there's lots of stuff that individuals can do. But being politically active is very important.
Okay.
I'll also put in a plug for the Millennium Alliance for Humanity and the Biosphere. It's at mahb.stanford.edu. And there's excellent current discussions, such as the one we're having right now, plus a taking action page that gets you in touch with some organizations that are doing things that are relevant to our discussion here.
And Dan, you want to...
No, I was going to agree with Paul that getting involved, getting politically involved, getting socially involved, listening to people, communicating with people is all essential.
And also reading, you know, there's a lot of information available on the web and elsewhere. Everybody doesn't, you know, if you hear somebody say exponential growth and you don't know what it is, you can Google it and you can learn about exponential growth.
I am so sorry to say that we are out of time. It's been wonderful to talk to both of you. I feel energized again. I've been massively depressed.
Welcome to the club.
Rita,
it's situational depression. Don't worry about it.
If you're not depressed, you're not thinking. Leave it at that.
Yeah.
That's right.
So you've been listening to Ecotopia on KZFR, and our guests have been Dan Blumstein, Professor of Ecology and Evolutionary Biology at UCLA, and Paul Ehrlich, President of the Center for Conservation Biology at Stanford. Thank you so much to both of you, and thank you so much for the work that you're doing, and thank you for being on Ecotopia and offering strategies to never let a good crisis go to waste. Thank you so
thank
much.
Thank you, and thank you for what you guys are doing. The communication is critical.
You are the new day. Say, you are the new
this night might stay yesterday. Thoughts that we as humans small could slow worlds and end it all.
You've been listening to Ecotopia on KZFR. Coming up at 7, it's Radioactive with Ginger Nichols. Next week on Ecotopia, as part of our Radical Change series, we'll be talking to Patrick Newman, a Chico area curmudgeon, letter writer, and deep thinker about what we need to do to change the world we live in. And then in 2 weeks, we'll talk with another deep thinker, Harvey Wasserman, who is the webmaster at Solartopia USA. He talks about solar issues, but a range of others, and has new interest in theft of the election and started a small group to preserve election freedom come next November. You can now get Ecotopia on podcasts. We're on Anchor, Google Podcasts, Breaker, Spotify, Public Radio, not NPR, podcasts. You can also contact us. You can look at our recent programs on EcotopiaKZFR.com. Send us an email at EcotopiaKZFR@gmail.com. Thanks very much for listening.
Weave me the sunshine out of the falling rain.
How you doing, Scooter?
Weave me the hope of a new tomorrow and fill my cup again. Sing it with me. Concrete crumble, shine on me again. The proud and the mighty all have stumbled, shine on me again now. Weave me the sunshine out of the falling, out of the falling. Weave me the hope of a new tomorrow and fill my cup again, fill it again now. Grows on the bank of the river of suffering, shine on me again.